Today in the Grave Talks, the haunted old Lavaca County Jail. What do you think of when you think abandoned jail? Butterflies and daisies? Of course not. Very likely your mind conjures up images of dark and decrepit cells rusting away in the stale, vacant air that time forgot. Possibly even unexplained sounds echoing down the lines of barred walls from the resident spirits that still take refuge behind the strong cinder block walls. If that's what you're thinking of, you may be thinking of the haunted old Lavaca County Jail. A jail no longer holding the living. No, now it houses the souls of those who have long since passed, but seem to have difficulty getting beyond the walls. This is the story of that jail, as told to us by Lisa Franks and Deborah Fawcett, today on The Grave Talks.
When I was 11 years old, I was diagnosed with diabetes. I was very sick at the time. And, you know, I was rushed over to the hospital from the doctor's office. And it was pretty much from that point that I started having experiences. I was in the hospital for about 2 weeks. And during that time, I would always see this older lady sitting down at the end of the hallway looking out the window. And I saw her for a couple days, and she'd always turn and smile. And, you know, I can picture her clear as day to this day, too. And a couple days later, I didn't see her. So I asked one of the nurses, you know, where's that lady? I always see her down the hallway. She always looks so nice and smiles and waves. And I just remember that nurse's face going white. And her saying that was a lady that had passed a couple weeks ago, like right outside that room. And she would always go and sit outside and look out that window. So that was my first experience. But I really don't remember any experiences before that. Sometimes, you know, they say that when you kind of have a near-death experience or, you know, you're very sick, that sometimes these senses can start up. So that's kind of how I remember mine starting from age 11. I remember going home, and I lived in the same house from when I was about 5 years old until I was about 18 or 19. So when I was 11 and got home from the hospital, I can remember every single night, a man probably in his early 60s, baseball cap, scruffy, piercing blue eyes, flannel shirt, just staring at me. And he was holding an axe. You know, I'm 11 years old. I'm terrified. You know, I'm not going to confront this person and ask them who they are, but I remember seeing him and being terrified, but he also looked terrified. This lasted every single night until I moved out of that house. I would sleep with a baseball bat. It was just terrifying. Luckily, I did have parents that were very understanding about paranormal stuff. Mm-hmm. My father grew up in a house that had a lot of activity. So when I brought this up to them, you know, I was very lucky because they didn't tell me, oh, you're imagining this, or, you know, oh, we don't believe you. They very much believed me and, you know, wanted to help in every way they could. I moved out of that house when I was about 19, and I really don't remember having any more experiences until my early 30s, when I would just try to go to bed at night and it would literally sound like talk radio was on. Like there were just people talking and talking and talking. I could hear people walking around the bed at night. I could see people sitting on my dresser at night. My oldest daughter, a good friend of hers, has a dad that was a part of a paranormal team. So her friend was at my house one night. We were just talking about paranormal stuff. And she's like, oh, you really need to talk to my dad because he's on a paranormal team. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And so I talked to him, and actually it was, I was about my mid-30s when I started with a paranormal team and started doing residential investigations, as well as going to different locations, and just having a lot of very personal experiences. I was lucky enough about 5 years ago to meet Ms. Deborah Fawcett, as I was my luckiest day ever, meeting Ms. Deborah Fawcett at one of the most amazing locations I've ever been to, and now have the privilege of helping run, and that's the haunted old Lavaca County Jail, and that's where I've been for the past 4.5 years, and paranormal experiences to this day.
So. And I want to hear your story too, Deborah, but I have a few questions I want to go to Lisa with first.
Sure.
So when you had these experiences growing up, and you're seeing this thing, these people with an axe, almost like from a different time period, that were in your residence. But they also, you said, looked just as surprised or terrified to see you.
That is correct.
When you look back on that, what do you make out was going on?
Well, that's a great question, because that bothered me for the longest time, because I could see this man as clearly as I am staring at Deborah Fawcett, who is sitting right next to me. Mm-hmm. It was that real. I have a psychic friend who is just the most amazing psychic ever, and I asked him about this one day, and he said that person, you know, was a lumberjack a long time ago that was clearing woods, you know, clearing the woods on the property that my house was built upon later on, decades later. Excuse me. He said that he was, you know, going through the forest, cutting down trees, and had a heart attack and died. Mm-hmm. So he, in that world, he doesn't realize he's dead. He's still working. Mm-hmm. So he's walking through the forest and he stumbles upon me. So I'm startling him as much as he's startling me. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. Now that's what I was wondering, if you were getting that take on it as well, because that's kind of the take I was coming to. And the interesting thing about you having these experiences in the house every day while you were there until you moved out. And then it seemed like there was quite a span of time between that and then having experiences again in your 30s. Do you think of yourself as a sensitive, or do you think, you know, you've just been in a couple places that happen to be super haunted that you were just able to pick up on because anybody could pick up on them there?
And I honestly believe that I am sensitive, mm-hmm. very much so. I think there's just a time where you almost don't want to accept it.
Okay.
And you don't want to deal with it. And you try to just push it out and not pay attention as much as, you know, and then I was having kids too. So, you know, that's always a good distraction. So.
Yeah. That distracts just a little bit. Yeah.
Just a little.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Now that's interesting. Cause I was wondering, you know, how you account for that open window of time. You know, and you know, from going from being that sensitive, but yeah, that does make a lot of sense. Where, you know, you get to that, you know, the age in your 30s and you start to kind of get more comfortable just with everything. And it's
okay. And that's what I was going to say too. I mean, when you're younger, I mean, it's really scary.
Sure.
And I mean, it's still scary to this day. Don't get me wrong, but you come to, you know, explore your things and you can think outside the box as you get older and, you know, you're able to accept it and want to help and want to know
and be more at peace with oneself, you know,
absolutely
at a certain point in time. Yeah. Very interesting intro story on your background. Deborah, let's hear where things all began for you.
Well, I didn't have any early childhood experiences, but I always had a strong interest in the paranormal. I'm elderly, so shut up, Lisa. When I first started having experiences was in the early 1970s, when I was a college student and was renting an old Victorian mansion that one other person lived in that house with me in an apartment upstairs. But I was taking a broadcasting class. And I knew a lot of things were happening in the house. I would hear footsteps when there was no one there, and things would get moved around or disappear completely. And I was sitting in a broadcasting class where we had to do a mock radio show as part of a class project. And I was at my house doing that, taping stuff on a reel-to-reel recorder, because mm-hmm. that's how we did things back then. And it was my first experience of hearing EVPs and capturing voices that I'm like, wow. I mean, reviewing it and going, wow, what the heck is that? And listening again and listening again, and really sparked my interest in EVPs, instrumental trance communication. Of course, back in those days, there was no internet. There were very few books on the subject. You couldn't find people like Jorgensen and people that were doing these early ITC experiments in different parts of the world. So, you know, it...
I was just going to say, at that point in time, like the concept of an EVP, barely anyone even would have known what that is.
Exactly. But I knew that it was something... you know, like Lisa, I'm a little on the sensitive side, and I could usually tell when there was someone around in that house. Mm-hmm. And I could connect that type of experience to capturing these voices. Well, then I got more deliberate with setting up the recorder and doing my own sessions of asking questions to see, am I getting anything relevant that will lead me to believe I'm actually communicating with someone. Mm-hmm. And started getting amazing answers to my questions. So I was down the rabbit hole after that with buying, all we had were tape deck. I mean, I remember we graduated to the cassette recorders, you know, it was, yeah, that's cool. It's a little easier to, at least I have something mobile I can take with me somewhere. But mm-hmm. I began doing lots of, I've always had a fascination with old homes, old buildings, historic sites, and just started doing it on my own of taking a recorder and doing my own research. And I mean, back then you were kind of shunned by people.
Sure.
If you mentioned that you were interested in the paranormal or doing that kind of, it was like telling somebody you were abducted. It was like, oh yeah, you just signed your papers, man, for your trip to the big house. But you didn't really talk about it so much. And I never really had anyone close to me that I shared any of this research I was doing with or really talked about it to anyone until Ed and Lorraine Warren came to my college. They were on the lecture circuit for a while back then. And it was like, oh my God, these are my people. These people have done this. They've got voices. And then discovered I could get books that they had written and copies of some of their transcripts from their college lectures. And so then I felt like less of a outcast, I guess, knowing that there are people out there who really are interested in this and doing research and finding out things. And I mean, as time progressed, I started investigating places around the country that would become popular in the later years. And I mean, we've been to everywhere. I still have some places on my bucket list, but it was just uncanny that my love for the historic buildings, the paranormal, and doing restoration just all fell into place when I discovered the old jail that Lisa and I run.
Yeah, let's start talking about the jail a little bit. I mean, how, you know, you obviously had this interest and this passion, and the world of paranormal has opened up so much since those early days. Obviously, now we have this sort of thing going on where people are getting into, you know, owning haunted locations for the sake of owning the haunted location and to research it. How did it come about with you falling into to being part of the jail?
Well, I had done some work in Hallettsville, where the jail is located, and people I was working with had mentioned the jail to me. Oh, you should go investigate this jail. I had been coming up here for a couple of years, but I never really went into town. So I didn't really know anything about the old jail. And I asked him, you know, does the county still own it? No, somebody private bought it. It closed in 2015. So I got online and found the guy who bought it, who's a man who owns a corporation called Rita Inc. He buys historic buildings primarily to be used as unique filming locations. Mm-hmm. So I contacted him. I knew he bought it like a year previous. He bought it in 2014 and told him I was interested in doing an overnight paranormal investigation at his old jail. And he said,
what?
You think it's haunted? I said, well, I it has every right to be. It's an old historic jail. And I said, well, what do you think? It's your jail. He said, I've only been in it a couple times, but yeah, you can come and I'll meet you there. So we met there. He and I, my husband, a couple of friends of mine from town here, and he gave us a walkthrough tour, and it was just like awful. It was disgusting. But I said, are you going to stay with us? He said, no, you can stay all weekend. And I said, well, you know, we're going to do some recordings. If I get anything interesting, I'll send it to you.
And he's like, please don't.
So, I mean, we were blown away. All the places that we've been. I mean, the jail was built in 1885. And served as the Lavaca County Jail until it closed in 2015. Mm-hmm. They needed more room. Twice the jail has been flooded with 8 feet of water on the inside of it. We're right there on the Lavaca riverbank. Mm-hmm. So the county didn't want to put any money into it. And because it's still in the flood zone, they built a new jail outside of town. And it sat empty for 10 years. Roger went in and made a bid on it and got it. He said, you know, I bought it as a long-term investment. I don't have time to work on it. So it's just kind of sitting there. So, I mean, after all the activity we got that weekend, I couldn't get that place out of my mind. And I told my husband, I said, I'm going to take over doing the restoration on this jail for Roger. He's like, what? I said, he's going to ask me to, and I'm probably going to say yes. Well, this time I'm running a busy medical practice in Houston. And so anyway, long story short, I started sending him stuff we were getting. And I said, you know what? Being privately owned, even though this place is like on historic registry, second oldest
continuously operating jail
in Texas. Should be number one by default. There was a fire with number one, but where was I going with that? We decided you need this restoration work done. I said, you know, with all the activity in here, a good way to supplement your restoration funding would be for us to allow professional paranormal groups to come in here and do overnight investigations, because I am telling you, this place is crazy active. People will love it. Oh, well, let's do that. I said, well, he goes, I don't know anything about doing that. I said, well, we can do this, but a lot of things have to happen first. We've got to restore the plumbing, the electrical, clean it all up. Make it look like the old jail wants to look. I mean, you walk through there now, there's a sheriff's office as it once was, a sheriff's bedroom, the booking areas as it was, the original flat bar cells upstairs are just like they were when they were built or erected there in 1885. But it really has, it just rolled into, yeah, I need the help. Yeah, I understand that this could generate us some income. I said, it's not, you know, this is not a money-making thing. We make our money from somebody coming and wanting to shoot a feature-length film there that involves cowboys and jail cells and things like that, because it's perfect for that.
Which we have done.
We've done heavy metal music video, yeah, weddings, funerals. But it just, I mean, it really, it was about a year, I guess, before we let the first group come. I said, yeah, I'm not going to put my name on a location that you have to wear a mask to come in a building because of the mold and the, the dirt. And there's going to be electricity. There's going to be plumbing. And there's going to be a shower.
We have working toilets.
We have a full kitchen. I mean, a lot of people will book the jail for an entire weekend because you can barbecue out in the backyard. It's very private.
So what is some of the...
You think of a jail... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. You said when you think of a jail...
Well, you think of an old jail as being like dirty and disgusting, and it's like really just the coolest place ever.
Everybody, it's so homey in here. I know. Roger's like, you need to stop cleaning it up so much. It's starting to look less creepy. I said, no, it's retaining the creepiness. It just can't have the filth layer on top of it.
It's museum status,
too. It is. It is also a museum, and we have a large collection of artifacts and things that people from the community have donated to us, but
Things we found in the ceiling.
Things that we find all the time as we're doing restoration. But I mean, it's been a joy doing all the, because I'm not from this area. I knew nothing about the jail or its history or the history of Lavaca County. But starting to do the research, we found 23 public hangings that took place there at a gallows that once stood in the jail yard, which now houses a covered garage and a little
bedroom for
a little building where Elise and I would always sleep when we came up here from Houston. We had groups here because we don't go in the jail with them or anything until I bought a farm recently out about 15 minutes from the jail. So now we're living it up
on the farm.
Cows and horses instead of sitting in our little room over there trying to be quiet while we have guests.
So what is the story of the jail? Does it have a storied history of interesting things that went on with it while it was an active jail?
Well, we don't have anyone really of notoriety that was housed there, like the James Gang or anything like that. Sure. But Hallisville was a wild west kind of town. There were shootouts on the town square. We had some very picturesque sheriffs who resided there, one of which is early Sheriff John Hutchins, who we're convinced is still there and doing his job and checks on us and has kind of befriended us. And but it's strange, the spirits we've gotten to kind of know on a personal level.
And they work for us. It's great.
I know. We got people coming tonight, man, kick it up. Boy, they do. But in the early days when it was just me in there by myself, and I consider myself a seasoned veteran, and I'm not easily spooked, but, oh, yeah, I ran out of there a few times. Lisa and I together have run out of there a few times.
Yeah, if she runs, I run. So.
Oh, yeah. If you see me run, yeah, it's getting real.
So tell me about once you came into possession of the jail and you started, you know, doing your things in there, cleaning it up, kind of getting it ready and all that. What were some of the first things that happened that you raised your eyebrows going, oh, yeah, this place, there's definitely stuff going on here?
I mean, I'd already had, you know, the usual haunting stuff, you know, hearing disembodied voices. Hearing something scoot across the floor, or door bang, or something like that. And you're kind of used to that. But then really, I don't know, I wouldn't say violent acts, but yeah.
A lot of energy acts.
A lot, yeah. A giant piece of concrete on the facade of the building that had been there for 130-something years. I had a... former deputy, been there for decades. His dad was, there was a previous sheriff and deputy that got shot and killed by prisoners that they were transporting. And this deputy was helping me. That was his father. And I heard stories about, you know, he wasn't the most well-liked, fair kind of guy. But after having him there for a day, he'd come over to help me with some stuff, with some locks. I went out to turn on the outside faucet, and as I stood up, a big concrete piece of facade fell right where I was standing, took out the faucet, took out all of our water, actually, for a couple of days. And there was a, I was walking through the back part of the building to close windows back there. And I went to close a window and I noticed that the window, there was no window to close. The window was gone. I'm like, what the heck? It's before we had electricity. So I had to get a flashlight. I'm looking around. Where's the window? I'm looking outside and it's like 50 feet from that window, twisted like a figure eight, laying in the yard. I had a paint can, a 5 gallon thing of commercial size Kills, holding open a big steel door on the back patio because it wouldn't stay open. And it probably weighed 50 pounds, 5 gallons. So I'm in an office around the corner mopping, and I hear this bang that shook the building, and it suddenly got dark. And this is like 10 o'clock in the morning. So I come walking around. It was in the break room back there at the end of the hall. Come walking around through the sheriff's lounge there, and I know the I see the door is shut. So I open the door. I'm looking for this 1,000-pound thing of paint, which is nowhere. Well, it's all the way across the kitchen, up against the counter, and I'm just like, thank you, God, for you know, taking the lid off. But, I mean, it had to come up over a ledge and into that room and across the across the room. That's before we had any furniture or anything in there. So after that happened, I'm like, yeah, okay, I got nothing to explain that. So, yeah, fair enough. So I go back to my mopping, and I hear a noise down at the end of the hallway, and it's far, way down. And I see, like, I guess what you describe is kind of like a shadow person kind of leaning out of a doorway. And it's the kind of thing you see for a second, you know, and you look, and of course there's nothing. And you're like, did I really see that? Okay, I'm back to mopping, and I look again, and at the end of that hallway is a door leading outside into a breezeway. So there's light streaming through there and everything. Well, when I look back, I can't even see that door. The whole part of that hallway, which is like a long tunnel, is just pitch black. And I'm like, well, that can't be good.
Yeah.
Again, no. I'm there all by myself.
That was a days before, Lisa.
But I'm thinking, you know, to myself in my head, yeah, I got to be here. I can't be scared. So I got to be the alpha dog right here, right now. So I made a gesture towards that at the end of the hall and said, yeah, not today. And looked back and it was all clear again. I'm like, okay, cool. We'll see who's a big pimp daddy here, you know? No. A tunnel of wind came down that blew my hair up, and I dove in two steps out the back door of that building. And said, okay, you win this round.
Call it a night.
Yeah, no, it's the middle of the day. I'm just getting started. But, I mean, things like, when you think, yeah, things like that that happen in the middle of the morning.
It's way more active.
We get so much more activity during the day. But I think in that mix, you have all the residual activity. I mean, you hear things like the normal operating sound, background sound of a jail, like a
doors slushing, keys,
doors, keys jangling, cart moving down the hall,
hey,
a body bag being dragged down.
Disembodied voices.
We do. We get a lot of that. But it evolved into
interdimensional. Oh dear God.
I mean,
kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, so many times we said to ourselves, yeah, just bring me back the boo. Bring me back an apparition in the hallway or a growl.
Scratch me again.
Scratch me again. Bite me. Anything. But we've had episodes of time loss, of seeing each other or hearing each other in places where we're not. So I guess you'd say like doppelganger type activity. Showing up in people's pictures when I wasn't with them. They're like, oh my God, you weren't even with us. I know.
And then both being kind of like, I don't want to say possessed by any means, but just kind of overtaken at the same time.
We were doing an ITC set or Ghost Fox session in the sheriff's office one night about a specific incident that had happened, and all of a sudden I looked at her and I'm like, why are you crying? She goes, why are you crying?
We didn't know we were crying. I don't even know.
And I'm like,
happening.
We need to go outside. Mm-hmm. This isn't right. Strange. We need to go outside.
But the time loss crap for me is just.
And having a recorder going where you get things. There was a night where I'll let you tell about the police sirens.
Is that what I'm telling right now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, we decided we had been doing some cleaning in the jail during the day. And we like to do that and then leave recorders running for like 20, 30 minutes and go and get the recorders and see what we get. Well, we decided one night to put a recorder upstairs and then put a recorder downstairs in the sheriff's bedroom. So we set the recorders and I set my timer on my phone for 20 minutes and we came outside and there's tables and chairs in the garage. So we were sitting right there. We never left. We sat there the whole 20 minutes. The windows upstairs where the upstairs cells are, those windows were open. So you could hear us talking. You couldn't hear exactly what we were talking, but you could hear our voices.
You could hear us mumbling in the background.
Yeah. So we sit there and we're talking and my phone alarm goes off 20 minutes later. So Deborah goes in and gets both the recorders and comes back out and we start listening to the first one, which is the one that was in the upstairs cells. So we're sitting there and, it's nothing, a couple little sounds here and there.
You hear us mumbling in the background. Mm-hmm,
and you hear us mumbling. And then out of nowhere, you hear, and I mean, it sounds like 10 to 15 to 20 police sirens stationary.
Pulling into the front of the jail.
They were pulling into the jail. And it went on like stationary, loud as can be, for over 2 minutes. So we're kind of looking at each other like,
that didn't happen.
That didn't happen.
I mean, we know all the police officers in town. We hear a siren. We're like calling them by name.
We know who it is.
We know who's working.
It's a small town. So that was like, we knew, we're like, what? And she's like, okay, well, let's listen to the recorder that was in the sheriff's bedroom. Because if it's not on there, then it's just some residual, not a big deal. Well, it was also on the recorder in the sheriff's bedroom.
And you were like, okay, I'm leaving and getting a motel room.
So literally for 2 minutes and 12 seconds, where the heck were we? Because I know we never left that garage, but where did those sirens come from?
That are documented
not
on
only on
two
one
different
recorders, but two.
And we didn't hear any of that.
It's like, oh, is my butt hurt? I was like, I don't know. It was scary.
But we've had other instances like that have happened to other investigators where they get their voice on tape saying things they never said, and then it like a lapse of time, and then there are actual conversations and things like that.
It's just very different. And that's when that was the one and only night I looked at her and I'm like, I'm going to get a hotel. I am not staying here tonight.
And I've been investigating for almost 50 years and longer than that. And just when you think you've got stuff figured out and you realize that you don't have a clue as to interdimensional type things that can figure into the mix. How many times I had discussions with ITC researchers about how do you know the voices you get on a ghost box are actually ghosts? When Frank made his first box, it was to contact alien life forms. And he thought for a long time that these were outer space communications he was having. And he's like, oh, yeah, these are dead people that I know. So, yeah. I mean, how do you know? You don't know.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Lisa and Deborah. In part two, what kind of time loss experiences did Deborah and Lisa have at the haunted old Lavaca County Jail? What do Lisa and Deborah make of their images showing up on people's cameras and pictures that they were not even present for? Is there anything in the building that feels threatening? Is there anything there that doesn't have a mutual respect for Lisa and Deborah? All of that and more in part two. To hear it, become a gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Sign up at patreon.com/thegravetalks. Or go to our website, thegravetalks.com, and click Become a Gravekeeper. $5 a month gets you access to all of our material, all of our archive of episodes, hundreds of them, waiting for you to binge away on, jam-packed with some of the best ghost stories you will ever hear. You also get access to advanced episodes and part two to all of our episodes exclusively for Gravekeepers, all of them commercial-free. Patreon.com/thegravetalks to sign up. Until next time, The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.